Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is going to miss the Google slate. Well, I'm going to miss the Google slate. You are too, right, Doc?
No.
All right. That voice you heard is Dr. Anirban Mahanti, of course, and I'm Scott Phillips. Oh, the Google slate is dead.
It is dead. Yay!
We'll get on to that.
I think Will is very happy about it.
We're talking about Google slate only because you make me talk about stuff that's not good about Google, pretty much.
Well, you know, Will was nodding his head in agreement.
I've got some bad news about Apple. We'll come into that.
Okay.
All right. So... we are off on a tangent so frequently early in these podcasts that really the tangent is the podcast, right?
That is true.
All right. Today on the tangent, we are going to talk about the new deal done by an infant formula maker in China. No, it's not A2. It's not even Bellamy's, but both did benefit from the deal. We'll talk about the bubble in Botox. That's right. Stay tuned for that one. Plus, the end of it. It's not just bad news for Google this week. The end of an era at Apple. One of the biggest influences on the Apple kind of product suite, the ecosystem, the design, the whole box and dice is going to close the door on his career, at least in one form or another, at Cupertino. And yes, we'll talk about the Pixel slate, plus maybe a couple of other things. Mate, let's get on with it.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
We have to start, though, with some big news for a little company. Now, we know infant formula has been all the rage here in Australia. Bellamy's was a hero, then a zero, then a hero again, and now somewhere kind of in between. A2 Milk goes from strength to strength. Allegedly a New Zealand company, but we're claiming them because that's what we do here in Australia. They're an Australasian hero, so they're now in the vein of Russell Crowe and Crowded House, now officially Australian. But the newest kid on the block, I think it's the newest kid. There's so many of them being launched from time to time, I can't really keep up. I think it's the newest kid on the block is Bubs, B-U-B-S. Now, A2 Milk has the A2 protein. Bellamy's has organic Australian. Tell our listeners, what's Bubs' point of difference again?
Bubs has got goat.
The greatest of all time.
It's basically got goat milk.
Oh, goat milk.
Goat milk.
Goat milk.
It's got all of Australia's goat milk.
And I have all of your milk. I've got a mental picture now of all the goats of Australia lined up with uniforms in the service of Bubs Australia. So something approaching all of the goat milk in Australia. I've got to ask, mate. So neither of us are nutrition experts. However, you've studied the company a little bit. Is goat's milk really a thing? I mean, obviously it's a thing. Is it something that matters? Is this just a kind of a marketing gimmick? What's the story with goat milk?
Well, apparently. Well, okay. So the disclosure is we have recommended this company in Extreme Opportunities.
Right. You're all in on goat milk.
We're on goat milk. A couple of things. I mean, there are studies that say that, you know, goat milk can be good for your digestive system, and it's, okay, you know, it's actually closer to human milk than, say, cow's milk. So if it's good for your babies and all those things. I think the bottom line here is that, you know, they basically make infant formula, and they sell a lot of their infant formula abroad, including into China.
Right.
And, you know, it's again selling quality Australian products abroad, high quality product that it can sell. And it's just a small company with a long runway. So I think that's the thesis here.
Okay.
And it got a little bit of a push on that thesis. So they've done some strategic deals in China.
So this is what I was going to ask. The shares are up about 18%. I think they closed on, was it Wednesday this week? On the news that they'd done some deals for distribution in China. Now, China is kind of the country that giveth and taketh away, depending on who you are. For a while, Treasury Wines and Blackmores were all in on China, and China was the big story until it kind of wasn't, and the share prices have suffered. Bubs is kind of treading that same path. The market loves it this week. 18% increase in the share price. That was pretty meaningful.
Yeah, like yesterday it was up like 31%.
Oh, 31?
Yeah.
Wow, I saw it at 18.
So,
there you go.
So I think that the deal here was that they've got a distribution deal with one of the largest mother and baby stores in China.
Okay.
And they're going to be, you know, basically being, you know, distributed in physical stores. And that gives access to customers, which is great. It creates brand awareness, and therefore, they, you know, hopefully will add to sales. So the company is saying it should might deliver close to $6 million of sales by 2020 from this deal. You know, I think it's a good deal for them if it works out the way they think it's going to work.
Well, these guys are small too, right? Like one of the benefits of being... So small can be wonderful or terrible. Small means you haven't got a great balance sheet necessarily. You haven't necessarily got the brand recognition. You're not the storied, well-known kind of go-to fallback brand. Something like a Blackmores might be, for example, or the Penfolds brand of wine sold by Treasury. So you don't have that strength. On the other hand, you don't have to do much to materially impact the value. This was $500 million, so $500 million company. By comparison, A2 Milk is a $10 billion company, so 20 times the size. So at one level, Bubs is more vulnerable. On the other hand, you do a little deal like this, it really can, well, as we know yesterday, put a 30% rocket under the share price.
That is correct. Yeah, I think that's the thing, that, you know, working off a small base with a novel product, in the sense that, you know, it's goat versus not cow's milk and so on. So I think that's the thing.
All the time.
So it's a little bit of a strategic placement. So far, they're executing well. It's a risky, I would call it a high risk, high reward type of company for all the reasons that you basically stated.
Very, very interesting. We'll see whether it comes off. Mate, those who've seen me know full well, I'm not exactly a Botox customer. I don't quite have the shiny, polished, unemotive, non-emotive look of a Botox user. And frankly, if anyone tries to stick a needle in my forehead, they'll be met with swift and significant retribution. However, it's something that plenty of people are doing, to the point where the Botox maker, now, is it Allergan? Is that how we pronounce it?
Allergan.
All right, you can pronounce it. I'll throw it to you. Is being bought out. Botox is that big these days that someone wants to buy. Is this a Botox deal? Is Botox just a sideline that everyone knows but no one really cares about these days? And more importantly, mate, what does this say about the appetite for takeovers, mergers, and acquisitions when it comes to the stock market right now?
So that's an interesting thing, right? So this is like a $90 billion deal.
That's
right?
A lot. That's 180 Bubses.
I know. For in a market which is not really that, you know, it's not really a growing market, right? So it looks like one company buying another and hoping to, you know, do what they call synergies in hope of getting growth. I'm not so sure about it.
Synergies and hope for getting growth. That phrase has been the rocks upon which many an investment portfolio has been dashed. Lots of expectation, lots of hope, lots of wishful thinking. I'll take a half a step back. The pharmaceutical industry, now this is mainly an overseas industry, we should say, so not a huge amount of local impact necessarily, at least not at that sort of scale, not at the $90 billion scale. To some degree, Matt, this was during the 90s, I should say, I was a kind of investor and I was watching the markets, as you probably were. And at that time, pharma was where everybody wanted to be. The growth was phenomenal, largely because these guys were absolutely minting it on the patents that had been registered and approved over the previous year or two, to the point where this was just a story of just you couldn't help but make money. Then all of a sudden, the kind of new blockbuster breakthrough drugs pretty much dried up, right? And so your point about slow growth, it's slow growth, yes, because the population's growing slowly and the Western world's kind of not getting super wealthy, so there's not a lot of growth there. The biggest problem for growth, at least versus historical norms for the pharmaceutical industry, is just there's no new blockbuster drugs. You know, as Pfizer's Lipitor, the anti-cholesterol drug, was one. Botox itself was a massive deal. Viagra, of course, we all know the little blue pill. I know by reputation, for the record, not from personal experience. These things were huge, and there's been almost exactly zero of them recently.
That's right. I think, again, there's a lot of buying going around in pharma because of that reason. That, you know, again, blockbuster drugs are hard to come by. And people are basically just trying to cut some fat and get some growth. Hopefully, they're not paying too much. I mean, that's the risk, right?
You might
just land up paying a lot to buy the growth that doesn't actually come by.
Well, there's no... I'm probably a cynic as a matter of course. And I try not to be. I'm actually an optimist by nature, as most of our listeners would know. But I look at a deal like this and I think, okay, I absolutely get getting costs out, right? If you can have one CFO rather than two, one CEO rather than two, one HR department, one payroll provider, one office building, or, you know, there's going to be hundreds of them around the country, but conceptually, if you can get rid of those costs, that's meaningful, right? That actually does add value to the bottom line of both businesses. So that's real. You just don't need the number of support staff officers, maybe even at a sales level, quite frankly. If your sales rep can sell two drugs rather than one, again, theoretically, there's many more drugs on both these companies' pipelines. But conceptually, if you can double the number of drugs you can sell, or relatively, that's a pretty good place to be. So I get all that. I just don't get the whole synergy for growth thing. I really, really, at a top line level, I'm yet to be convinced that any or almost any two companies side by side, with the exception of the old software land and expand stuff, which we've talked about before, but for most companies, particularly $90 billion deal companies, it's not like all of a sudden they're going to be able to reach some customers they weren't previously. Or I mean, is there really synergistic growth? I hate that phrase, but I'll have to use it. Is that really even possible, or is this kind of wishful thinking by some CEOs who are kind of throwing the Hail Mary pass and trying to do something?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with you and say that, you know, there's a lot of wishful thinking here. Again, it's hard to see how it directly even fits into this company's portfolio, which is again a big question mark.
That's
right.
Right. Like even if it did, I still can't see the growth. It's still, yeah. I get the cost out stuff. I think that, I mean, cost out can be really, really meaningful. In fact, you know, look, bring it back home here for a second. The supermarket retailers in particular, so over the 80s and early 90s, they bought up effectively the entire waterfront. Woolies bought Safeway, for those who live in Victoria, way back in the day. You know, Woolies bought Australian Independent Wholesalers out of Canberra at one point. Woolies and Coles between them had something like a 40% market share in the early 80s. They're now up to about 80, 85%, depending on how you define the category. Largely a combination. Fleming's was bought by Woolies, of course, back in the day. Franklin's went broke, I think, twice. It's you know, you can absolutely get big by taking out competitors, simply concentrating, consolidating the market. But in this case, you're not really selling, you know, those just are commodity products where it makes sense to only have one supermarket rather than two, right? Those things just make straight out sense. Take out a competitor, take out some cost, put more people in the current supermarket. That makes sense. Two very different drugs. Very, very hard to see how you get growth out of it.
Yeah, we'll see.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's go to the tech corner. We should have a segment name. If Will was looking after you, we'd have a logo. We'd have a sound effect. We'd have
you want some. We're having an opener.
Well, is there something that sort of, you know, something? No, I'm kidding. If people have heard our podcast, well, they know it's not going to help. You can only save so many people so many ways. Trust the sound effects aren't going to save us. However, let's talk about tech. We like to do that a little bit. And frankly, that's because most of people out there, even if you don't own tech, you certainly use tech. And the two big companies, at least in the handset space, are Apple and Google. And we have news from both this week. Both bits of bad news, I would say, mate. Normally, you get to tell me how terrible Google is, and occasionally I try and tell you how bad Apple is. This week, not great news for either company, though the sizes are probably roughly, you know, the same because they're almost immaterial, but net negatives for both companies. The first, let's go with Apple. We'll do it alphabetically, and because I'd rather talk about Apple's bad news before Google's. And I will say, as we always do, you own Apple, I own Google, such is the way of these things. There were three men at Apple a decade ago who were responsible effectively, not solely. We tend to lionize CEOs and senior execs in a way they probably don't deserve. However, and we blame them too, by the way, to the extent they don't always deserve. However, at Apple, hard to overstate the importance to Apple of Steve Jobs himself, of Tim Cook, his operations guy who became CEO, and of Jony Ive, the kind of designer extraordinaire who effectively designed the iPod, had a massive hand in a whole lot of other tech before and since. Jobs, of course, moved on to a different plane. Tim Cook now running the company, and Jony Ive, the guy, the design genius behind a lot of Apple's tech in the last 20 years, is leaving the company.
That is correct.
That's surprising. Although on one level, not oversurprising. Look, let's before we do get into the what, tell us a little bit about Jony Ive. Tell us what he's been doing, and tell us why you think he's leaving and what it means for Apple.
So Jony Ive has been with Apple for over 30 years, right? He started as a designer, or he's part of the what's called the industrial design group.
Sounds like Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's kind of film company going?
Yeah, exactly. These are the guys who you know think about products that people have not even thought of yet.
And this is kind of cool. When I think design, I think drawing dresses or buildings on a piece of paper. Or maybe kind of working out where the icons go. But this is a really holistic, like design in an Apple hardware world is kind of like, it literally is imagining products almost kind of, right?
It's imagining new things, how they're going to look, how they're going to feel, how you're going to touch them, how you're going to use
them.
This
is the guy who literally said, hey, I'm going to design a music player and it's going to look and feel like this. And here's how big it's going to be. And here's how, remember the old scroll wheel? Well, you do, of course, because you're an Apple fan. For anyone listening, try and remember. I know we're 20 years past that now, or whatever it is. Think back to when you first touched the scroll wheel, and you could literally get things to move on the screen by moving your finger across a solid surface.
Exactly.
Like it's so common now. I could never convince my 6-year-old that this thing is important or interesting, or we actually had a world without it. But I can still remember using the thing, and I can remember my sense of wonder and almost disbelief.
Yeah.
When he literally designed from scratch, knowing a little bit about electronics, a little bit about design, a little bit about how humans would use these devices, the old human, was it human?
Human interface? Computer there interaction or human interface design.
There you go.
Right.
He kind of, I won't say he necessarily gave birth to the whole idea, but he certainly is one of the greatest exponents, certainly of our generation and by definition almost every generation because computers aren't that old. He's the guy, right?
He's the guy. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, you think about designing the iPhone, the touch screen, the if you think about it at that time, the BlackBerry was around, right?
Right.
And the BlackBerry had a physical keyboard.
I love that.
Because everybody basically thought that you need have a physical keyboard.
I've told this before. I was made to use an iPhone when I changed companies. And I was dirty as. I was like, no, I like my BlackBerry. It's got a physical keyboard. It's great. It's easy to use. Yeah. I'm never going to use this bloody iPhone thing. It's all a bit of a, you know, hype and a fad and all that kind of stuff. And I have nothing against Apple. I like my Google phone, but I have nothing against Apple. Within about a month of using it, I'm like, oh man, I was so wrong. This thing is great. Yeah.
So I mean, this is a guy who has been, you know, behind every Apple product, every successful Apple product. He's also the voice of so many of the ads that Apple do.
Oh, really?
Does, right? You know, like when they launch a new product, there's like a Johnny Ive basically talks in his English, you know, special English accent about, you know.
I did not know that.
He even thinks like, you know, like the, you know, the aluminum in this, you know, Apple computer. So this is really like, I mean, the end of an era in one way. At the same time, what the interesting thing is that for the past 5 years, he was basically busy designing Apple's Apple Park, like what looks like a spaceship.
Sorry, what's Apple Park? Might help us with that.
That's basically Apple's next or new headquarters in California, basically. So Apple Park basically was the last thing that Steve Jobs approved of before he died.
Right.
And, you know, then Apple spent about 5 or 6 years building this huge spaceship-like building. Mm. It's the new headquarters. So he spent, you know, most of his time working on building the interior and the exterior and getting that designed. In many ways, if you think about it, like, I mean, there's a whole slew of designers at Apple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, given the fact that Johnny was not associated directly with, say, the Apple Watch, for example, Apple Watch was designed while he was busy designing Apple Park. So this marks, in my mind, this is a way of this guy saying, well, you know, I wanted to do different things and I wanted to design a building. This opens up the possibility for him to do things other than just doing things with Apple and just doing things in the consumer, consumer hardware space.
Mm-hmm.
And his first customer is going to be Apple. He's going to be still there for some time with Apple before he moves over to this company called LoveForm. Along with him, there's going to be Mark Newson, who, you know, has famously designed Qantas's Skybeds.
It's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. So those two guys are going to go form their own company. They're going to have Apple as a customer. Maybe they're going to design, you know, things like the Opera House or something equivalent, or some bridges or some buildings and other things. In addition to consumer hardware, you know, also internally, I felt that, you know, the worst thing this can happen is they might, you know, seeing Johnny Ive design, say, the Fitbit or the next generation. That would be really not good.
because you were just biologically driven to hate everything that competes with Apple or something else?
Well, it's just, you know, when I look at the Fitbit, I think, like, I just don't like this product.
But wouldn't it be cool if Johnny Ive could actually improve? I mean, isn't that the kind of, at some level, I would say every designer, but some designers have got to say, you know what I really want to do is go and take a thing that's broken and make it beautiful. Like, you know, at some level, you know, Ive was able to create, not so an Apple music player that was broken, but was able to bring beauty to a whole lot of stuff that otherwise might. So, you know, taking the BlackBerry and turning it into something beautiful like the iPhone. At some level, I mean, there's got to be something. I'm a Fitbit user, so maybe I'm biased and I don't really care about Fitbit. I don't own the shares. But at some level, if you know, wouldn't it be nice to think he could go and actually make Fitbit a nicer device? Wouldn't that kind of be a net positive overall?
Well, no.
Because it competes with Apple?
Well, not just because, you know, philosophically, I think to me, good design actually lives in three things. It lives in hardware,
mm-hmm.
it lives in software,
mm-hmm.
and it lives in the interaction between the hardware and the software.
Right.
Right? I think this
but
is...
But if I could fix that, That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but this is a cultural thing. It's a company thing, right? I mean, there's no way I just can go and fix Google's, you know, human-computer interaction. I mean, there's just no way Google is going to ever learn that. It's just not in that company's DNA. Its DNA is how to steal people's data.
Oh, so it's going to do that. Go. Right? We'll cut this out of the podcast, don't worry.
And Fitbit just doesn't, you know, these are things, I think these are long-lasting, it's like it's people culture to some extent. So right. This is hard to recreate. And, you know, this is basically what separates Apple from the rest.
That's the question I have, and I'm not expecting to get an unbiased answer from you. But at some level, the last 20, 25 years of Apple's dominance has been a Jobs, Cook, Ive co-production. I mean, you know, at some level, yes, there are people that work for them. They're great, fantastically talented people who I'm sure would be horribly offended by my characterization. At the same time, Jobs was famously dictatorial. Cook wasn't necessarily, but certainly was a brought some level of genius to operations and supply chain. You know, part of the ability of Apple to do so much at such low cost, relatively speaking, and so well is due to Cook. And the whole design thing, while I've ran the team, I'm sure there are other people who contributed, but no one really, you know, argues that Ive wasn't the creative brain behind a whole lot of this stuff. In a world where, yeah, Cook's now the CEO, and I'm not underplaying that at all, but he's not only the operations guru, although I'm sure he retains a keen interest. Jobs is gone. Ive is going. This is probably the biggest, I don't want to overstate it, but is it not close to one of the bigger tests in Apple's history now to try and prove that it can continue to, not just survive, it can survive, of course, but innovate successfully without those kind of really strong-willed men with great reputations and, frankly, a lot of instinctive greatness that they got to lord it over everyone else to say, no, we're doing this thing because I see the future. If Ive's replacement is not of the same ilk, does that run some degree of risk for Apple? Are you not just a little bit concerned about an Apple post-Ive?
I am. Like, I mean, you know, like Ive's leaving is not a good news. I take that. But I think, you know, I call Apple one of the greatest companies to actually live.
You do.
And I actually believe that in the sense that, you know, its contribution to mankind is you know, at par with many others or probably one of the greatest.
If we didn't have Apple, we couldn't spend all day on Facebook. That's a actually think
well,
about that.
You wouldn't have Facebook. You wouldn't have things like Uber. You wouldn't have so many things that we have. The whole entire
So if we had to give up Apple and Facebook, would that be a net negative or net positive?
Oh, getting rid of Facebook. Getting rid of Facebook, I think, is a net positive for the world.
Maybe without Apple, maybe there's no Facebook. That could be a win.
Yeah, but you know, but I think the greatness of a company is its ability to transform over time.
Yeah, totally.
And I think if Steve Jobs has done one thing right, he might have, you know, made sure that that you got the right people in the right place who will ensure that the company can transform over time.
Well, he's done bloody. I mean, you know, he's been gone for what, a decade or so?
Almost a decade now,
and,
right?
And Apple's done very, very well without him.
Yeah.
And I guess the next generation question, though, is, you know, Cook is now the CEO, maybe for not all that much longer. Ive is now going. This is where the rubber hits the road on that question, right? Is did those guys leave a legacy beyond their own genius?
And I would think the answer would be yes. I mean, you know, Microsoft is a great example of that, right? Mm. You know, they've got, you know, Satya Nadella leading it fabulously. Sometimes you just need to do that, right? And good companies would hire the right people. It's a lot about the culture, as I said. If the culture is right, if the design-centric culture is there, if there's the hardware-software integration is there, then you've hired the right people to lead the company to the next sort of generation. Then sometimes new blood is actually what you need, right? You want new blood to actually bring new
ideas. That's the question. So Steve Ballmer took over. So back to Microsoft. Steve Ballmer took over from Gates and was roundly panned for a very long time as leading Microsoft into a kind of morass of mediocrity, my phrase, but it's alliterative, so I like it. Nadella, in theory, is the great hope coming out of the company now to restore or maybe just simply deliver on some of that promise. You know, Microsoft, some people would actually criticize Microsoft, say it's not that business. Ballmer is evidence that post-Gates, this thing was a rudderless ship for a very long time, and Nadella is less about the evidence of that great culture than a Hail Mary pass thrown by the board to try and fix Ballmer's mistakes, or vice versa. To what degree do we, you know, can we draw that straight line and say, well, they've got a good leader now, they had a good leader then, therefore this is cultural, or is it just a case of they were lucky enough, fortunate enough, clever enough to pick the right guy to lead the company.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe it's a little bit of both, because I mean, Ballmer gets a lot of criticism, but I would say that, you know, the cloud for Microsoft did not happen overnight, right? So it is true that Nadella was leading the cloud division, but it was approved and was done and was a strategy enacted during Ballmer's time.
Right.
Ballmer did miss mobile, but so did Bill Gates. I mean, Bill Gates was a consultant and involved in product decisions. Yeah. I mean, you know, he missed it too. So, I mean, you know, the thing is that big companies, great companies may miss things, but, you know, if they have great balance sheets and if they've got great products and if they've got, you know, people still using them, they, I think they have the opportunity to, I guess, reinvent themselves.
I'm going to ask you an absolute tangent question, mate, because I like to do these things. You were talking about mobile and the fact Microsoft missed it. And my immediate thought, as you mentioned, that was one of the great fault lines of technology kind of advancement, right? Or maybe a step change, pick your analogy. But effectively, that's when everything took a 90-degree turn and you're either on the boat or you weren't on the boat. You either got mobile, you led the charge. Microsoft tried with the Zune and failed. They tried with their own phone and failed. Apple took off. Google probably had the good fortune or good judgment to buy Android and kind of maintain their place in that. Otherwise, it could be a very different story. So maybe Apple's smart, maybe Google's lucky, maybe Microsoft's either unlucky or not smart or something else. So there are from time to time, and we haven't seen a huge amount in our kind of modern internet world, but that's one really, really key step change / 90-degree turn that the market took or technology took and that people either missed or got. If you're a betting man, what's the next one or the current one? What do you see? You're a technologist by trade, by training, by interest, by investing style. If I was to say to you, what's the next big 90-degree turn that technology is likely to take? It can be, and this is a very vague question without notice, so listeners, if Doc doesn't answer immediately, it's my fault, not his. But if you said, look, you know, here's the next big trend that is you know, sizable enough to be the equivalent of moving from desktop to mobile, and not necessarily in that space necessarily, but what would you, if you've got a couple, if you've got one that you'd sort of say, hey, here's what you should be watching out for, or here's what I'm excited about, or here's what I've been thinking about?
So I think the biggest one, at least in consumer tech, would be, in my mind, it's wearables. Okay. And that's already happening, right? I mean, it's happening in different shapes and forms, but it's still tethered in many ways to the phone. Which is whether you talk about AirPods or you talk about, you know, wearables like a Fitbit or Samsung Watch or the Apple Watch. I think with 5G, we're going to probably get to a stage where we become untethered from the phone. Mm-hmm. And that might bring in things like, you know, an Apple Glasses, for example. And that opens up a whole lot of possibilities in augmented reality and virtual reality. So I think that's where we are likely headed. And I think then the
relate wearables is that code for glasses specifically? Is that the big wearable that's going to have be meaningfully kind of, you know, the step change that we're thinking about?
Well, I think we are on the way to replace the phone with something, right? Okay. And that could just be something
literally like, replace or augment.
I think replace.
So we literally leave the phone at home, take the glass or whatever the wearable thing is.
Yeah. Wow. So right now you can wear the Apple Watch and not have the phone with you.
Right.
And it basically will work for you.
Okay.
Right. So my Apple Watch does not need the phone.
Right.
Right. It's tethered to the phone in the way that, you know, it's got the same number. Mm. But I think that's just an artificial connection.
It's
right
the
now.
eSIM technology, is that right?
Yeah, it's the eSIM technology. So we're going to eSIMs.
Okay.
With the eSIMs, you know, effectively you can have any phone number associated with any device as long as it's got the eSIM in it. So I think that's where we're headed.
Okay, interesting. There you go, Phil. You heard it here first. Keep an eye on wearables. I assume you're going to say, Doc, that Apple is the company leading the charge. They're most likely to. But if you had to pick a second, is there a company you're watching? Is there a particular tech you're looking out for? Just to give our listeners something else. I know I'm asking lots of questions without notice here, but if you had to put your money, a couple of chips, you put most on Apple, I would guess, but feel free to say no. On top of that, as well as that, instead of that, what would you be looking at?
So I don't think there is any. I think right now the way the consumer technology works is basically Apple is going to create an industry which others are going to follow. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it has been ever since the iPhone. Mm. And it's hard
Come on, Microsoft invented the tablet.
It invented the tablet until
Microsoft Newton. Come on, dude. That was the first one out of the gate.
Yeah, but none of these companies basically are able to create mass accepting devices, right? So it's basically up to Apple to actually create an industry, get people to accept it, and then the other copycats come, so which is fine.
I wish I had enough time to unpack that, because there is something really fascinating about exactly that idea. the idea of creating a product or a technology is only part of the exercise, right? Actually creating something that people want to use, can make to be easy for people to use in a way that people want to use it. Back to Johnny Ive himself, that very idea of, Microsoft was literally the first tablet computer, right? Yeah. Back in 1980-something. A combination of the tech wasn't ready, broadband wasn't ready, Wi-Fi didn't exist, all that stuff. There was reasons why a tablet computer never took off.
Well, the Palm Pilot.
Yeah, right, exactly. so was huge for a little while.
There are companies which create stuff, but they can't create an industry
and
a market. And then there's Apple, which can basically create an industry and a market, right?
Without necessarily having to invent the tech, they're kind of seeing the potential. I have in my head a vision of Apple going around a virtual kind of digital scrapyard and taking the things that are there and kind of making this new thing out of it, not necessarily in a Frankenstein-y kind of way, but in a sense of like, hey, we could use that touchscreen and that idea of a handheld calendar and the idea of a phone, and if we kind of jam these together, look what we could do that people will love. It's almost that, right?
I think the greatest thing about Apple is basically figuring out the human computer interaction. But everybody else thinks about the technology, right? So you can have great technology, but if it's not usable, it's not good, right? So I think that's where Apple excels, and I think that's basically Apple's DNA is to make stuff usable and accessible.
Very cool. I think we should move on.
Yeah, let's talk about other stuff. I'm looking forward to it.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Try and contain your excitement, Doc.
I am very excited. I'm like really pumped.
Should we talk about ASIC?
No.
No?
No.
What do you want to talk about?
Slate.
Microsoft online portal.
I've got a segue too. We are slated to talk about Slate.
Oh, tell you what, you're on fire. Maybe you should be hosting the podcast. Unfortunately, you know more about tech than I do, so I'm better to ask the questions. So yes, as much as it pains to me to admit it, Google's Slate, which was their tablet, the Pixel Slate, apparently is dead.
It's not apparently. It is actually dead.
Well, it still kind of exists now, but it's been slated. use your pun for death. It is no more.
It is no more. So I mean, the news here basically is that Google is not going to try to compete with the iPad because it can't compete with the iPad. There's a difference here. They're still going to be releasing the Android OS for tablets,
right? Okay,
for the other people to actually make the tablets. But it's just not going to compete in the hardware space.
So the Pixel range, according to Apple, according to Google, it was supposed to be the best-in-class version of how the software could be effectively used well, right? The idea was kind of, we will make the prototype, I don't know what you call it, it's probably a technical name for it, but we'll make the perfect design, the perfect version of this stuff so the software works as well as it should with the phone that should work for. To give consumers a choice, but also B, to give the hardware makers something to kind of, not about aspire to necessarily, but certainly compare themselves against, or just to give some sense of this is what the perfect version of an Android-powered device might be. That's kind of a laudable goal. You can argue about whether or not that was ever supposed to be a commercial success or how successful it was supposed to be. I'm sure Google would say, well, gee, if we sold a million of them, we'd be pretty happy. They couldn't make tablets work. Here's an interesting question. You and I have a very different view on tablets. It's probably because we have our different software and hardware allegiances. But this is either a sign of Apple dominating a market, or it's a sign of a market not really being that big. I have to say, I did a quick search for tablets the other week for my mum. And there's the iPad. There's half a dozen different versions of Samsung, and there's a couple of little bitsy cheap tablets, and a Kindle Fire and a Lenovo tablet, and a few little tiny things. Other than that, kind of Apple's got it to itself, which either means it's swamped the market, and when the tablet market becomes huge, Apple wins, or maybe there's not enough sales in the category to go around.
So I have a different answer to that, and I think
I'm
call
very
it.
Surprised.
so the market is not as big as the phone, but it's a pretty big market, right? And aside from that, I think it's a little bit of Apple's marketing genius that has actually killed everybody else.
Okay.
So I think one of the things that Apple did previously is that did not have low cost product. With the iPad, they changed that.
Okay.
So basically, they have a range of products which basically ranges from $250 to all the way to $1,300, $1,500, right?
Jeez,
or $2,000.
Yeah.
So they got the premium end.
Yeah.
And for those people who were going to buy the Androids for cheaper, mm-hmm. it was the cheaper iPad.
Right, so, okay. So crowded them out.
They've crowded them out, right? And there's okay. no real differentiation in the software from that Android can offer. And then at the other end, I think you can see how well Surface has done, right? Now, Surface is not really a tablet, but can be used as a tablet.
Sure.
Right? And it's mostly more of in the desktop, sort of, the laptop.
Variant. Yeah, it's a detachable laptop rather than a pure tablet, right?
Right, but it's a detachable thing. So those people who want to be in the Windows environment, they've got that.
Oh,
and
yeah,
Apple has basically squeezed out the Android guys out of the market, right? And, it could actually do that on the phone. That would be very amazing.
That's what led me to think about this. I mean, if you think about the phone, I mean, there's two questions here, right? We're talking about the Pixel, which is Google's hardware. In phones, yes, there's a Pixel phone. I happen to own one, but the Android software powers much, much larger share of a whole lot of other devices than Apple's iOS does, just because it's a single manufacturer and Apple has a lower handset share than it has a tablet share. Mm. So that's kind of my question. At some level, this either goes one of two ways, right? Either the hardware makers have never been able to replicate their success in phones, or Apple's never been able to replicate its success in tablets into phones. Either way, it's kind of interesting next 5 years in terms of how this might evolve. If you're a betting man, do you think Apple will gain share of that lower price segment in phones, or is it always going to be too big a market? Phones are mass. Tablets are relatively specialized, at least a big market, but much, much, much smaller than phones. Is it just the nature of the market, or is there something else likely to go on?
So I think to answer the second question first, I think the tablet market is going to grow because the way Apple has been positioning it, and you can see that from the Surface as well, is that it's becoming a replacement of standard desktops or standard laptops. Yep. So I think the tablet market is going to grow. This is basically, as I said in one of my tweets, I think the Pixel phone is going to be gone in a couple of years as well.
Right.
I think it is very hard. It's just, I think hardware is just hard for Google, given that it's not really Google's primary business, right? And it's competing against its licensees, right? So it's basically Google Pixel is competing, Pixel Slate or whatever, is basically competing with Samsung at this at that price range, right? And if you make the price lower, it's basically competing with Huawei or Mate something.
And plenty of others, Oppo and other things.
Oppo and plenty of others, right?
Yep.
So it's not Google's core competency, and Google cannot really offer anything substantially different compared to the other guys.
Right, by definition.
Right.
The Android OS is the OS.
Is the OS. Yeah. So I think it's just Google's realization that if I have to say something, I think their whole strategy here has been about trying to gain share into the home, and it's and they have been successful there, right? Google Home is successful.
Yeah.
And that's basically one something that Apple has dropped the ball on, is trying to gain share into that and then getting into sort of the home market and building IoT share, so Internet of Things share, and having a share in the voice market. Mm. So I think those are Google's primary interests. And I think I really think that Pixel phone is going to be gone in a year or 2 years. I think it's again not selling very well. So
and I don't really, maybe I'm biased, but I don't think Google ever really expected it to be a market-killing phone. It was always supposed to be a top-end, best-case kind of live version. I mean, I'm sure they would have happily taken it. If there had been a roaring success, they would have taken it. But it was never kind of designed to sell mass volume, right? It was always supposed to be, hey, here's what it could look like if you guys, as hardware makers, pulled your socks up.
Yeah, I have a hard time buying that argument, largely because, what's wrong with Samsung's phone on Android, right? Mm. I mean, it's basically Android running.
Except for the bloody bloatware.
Yeah, but
that's actually why I bought a Pixel. I like Google. I don't love Google. I mean, we play up the rivalry just because it's fun for the podcast. I like Google. I use lots of Google services. I'm more than happy with my phone. If Samsung would sell me a non-bloatware kind of all that, or any of the makers, if they could literally say, I'll give you the phone without the rest of my company crap, I'd take it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, but I mean, every company is going to do a little bit. They're going to do something on the camera. So those are the things they have to differentiate. Otherwise, there's no way to differentiate them, right?
Yeah,
so everybody's going to do something with the camera, a little bit here, a little bit there.
That's kind of hardware. I mean, I suppose the software that goes with
it. It's the hardware and the software. They're going to do a little bit there. Otherwise, they have nothing to sell. I mean, that's their problem, right?
But I don't want to use the Samsung store, and I don't want to use Samsung's mail clients. Like, go away. Let me use the.
Yeah.
That's my personal problem.
Well, let's just. You like to suffer, so it's your problem, really, right?
You can never give a sucker an even break, I reckon.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, talk about giving suckers an even break. That's actually a pretty good segue this time. I'm getting better at this.
You're getting awesome.
Mate, another 150-odd podcasts and I will be slightly better than I am now, which is good. Speaking of giving a sucker an even break, ASIC, the corporate regulator. So ASIC gets a hard time from a whole lot of people for a whole lot of reasons. And often those reasons tend to lie around the fact that they haven't exactly shown themselves to be super active when it comes to really getting stuck into the wrongdoers. They've settled with the banks rather than prosecute them. They occasionally get some low-grade kind of targets and successes, but it hasn't exactly, you know, those who criticize it want them to see bigger, you know, really marquee action that meaningfully changes the way financial services are provided in the country. And that makes a whole lot of sense. We might just get that. This week, two big stories in the AFR. One was, I'll read the headlines for the fun of it. Watch us grill the banks over their lending practices, says the ASIC chief. The second one, ASIC to ban toxic products from August. Mate, I love these two headlines. If they are even slightly true, I will do cartwheels. I'm just super excited that ASIC is finally basically standing up to the bad guys, right? And not that banks are all bad guys or every product provider is a bad guy, but gee, it'd be nice to know that ASIC was successful in really, you know, actively being involved in fixing the biggest problems that we have in the financial services sector. So let's go through this. The first thing, grilling the banks over their lending practices, I've got to say, as much as I'm happy with the headline, I then found out they're going to put a psychologist in the boardrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I love psychologists. I'm not a doubter of the value of psychology or psychiatry at all. So let me put that on the record. This is not about me being, you know, poo-pooing that whole thing. That being said, I don't know whether a corporate regulator's strongest weapon is a psychologist in a bank boardroom, is it?
Oh, I don't know. So I'm going to first correct one thing.
Okay.
One of those headlines was actually from, not from the Fin, but from the Sydney Morning Herald.
Sorry, thank you.
So
appreciate it.
Let's you know, give the credit where the headline came from. Well, when I saw it, my first reaction was really psychologists.
I mean, again, they're important.
And yeah. You know, as a former scientist, I have huge respect for, you know, doing work in science. Well, there's some argument here, like the flim. Oh, I was going to say flimsy. I almost said
Freudian
it.
Well, slip. Exactly.
It slipped up.
But you didn't, so that's good.
Yeah, but I didn't. The argument here is that, you know, people with behavioral aspects, behavioral learning, like we as we say in investing, right? Mm. Behavior is a real huge part,
yep.
And maybe people who sit in the boardrooms of these companies, behavior, you know, falling in the usual, you know, behavioral traps is a big deal. And if somebody can, some from the outside, so I get the logic. Although, you know, honestly, I think the bigger problem that ASIC should be looking at and that doesn't really require a behavioral behavioral expert there is, you know, are the boards are there to oversee, right? And are they doing that? Are they actually keeping the shareholders' interest in? So I think it's regulating the stuff that we expect them to regulate.
Yeah, okay.
Is what I would like to see, you know, are the insiders following the trading rules that are there? Are they, you know, there's the disclosures up to the mark and things like that. Mm-hmm. Those things to me mean a lot more. But maybe there's some benefit like to this. I don't know. I'm going to be open minded, and say, I am willing to see what's going to happen.
I will absolutely line up behind that one. I think I'm. My biggest concern, I think, well, look, you know, we're all experts, right? And I'm mindful that ASIC does actually is the genuine expert, whereas I'm just a commentator on the outside. But it's hard to and behavioral understanding, measuring, catching behavioral issues, I think is really, really important. I don't think there's anybody who really watches the banks closely with any sort of critical eye who doesn't know or think they know. The basic issue is just incentives, right? Like for all the problems with the banks, for all the things that we can do or not do, for all the psychologists in the boardrooms, you fix the incentives, don't you fix the behavior? Like I'm happy with the psychologist being there, yes. But it's like, so guys, you're going to do nothing around the incentive stuff until or unless your psychologist says you to do something. It feels to me like they know there's a problem. We can reasonably assess what that problem is and diagnose the problem. And yet they're saying, yeah, but despite that, we'll send to the psychologist. I'm a little bit mindful they are, as much as I just said, I'm glad they're taking action. Is it really action, or is it kind of, oh, we'll spend another 12 months doing some research analysis? Couldn't they make some changes now?
Oh, that's true. This could be like, this looks like another Royal Commission Part 2 sort of
doesn't
thing,
it?
Right? Yeah. I think maybe the tack here is that the incentives are the problem, but you know, you need someone there from the outside who says, okay, look, you're thinking too much about your incentives, right? Maybe you need to think a little bit, you know, especially for things like banks, which are really critical to sort of the way our economy works, right? You know, it's not just about making the bank insiders happy or the shareholders happy. They also are actually got very important, they're very important stakeholders in the economy, right? So they need to take a little bit of a broader perspective, a societal perspective.
Too big to fail, right? That's kind of, I mean, at some level, if our banks fail en masse, the economy falls over.
Exactly, which is why I think they have a societal responsibility as well, right? So, I mean, and most companies will say that they, you know, they do things for the society at large.
Yep.
I mean, something probably is better than, you know, here's the shining bright light here. If you put 20 people, 20 experts in one particular behavioral subject who hopefully are going to be outsiders, right? There is a little bit more outsider oversight on the bank boards or not just bank boards, but the boards of these 20 companies. Maybe it's a net positive instead of having, you know, more of the same.
Can't hurt, I suppose. Oh. So that's that. What I do absolutely love, unquestionably, is the fact that ASIC are reported to be moving on what they call toxic financial products. And these are the stuff that's designed to make the providers of the products rich at the expense of you, me, and our listeners, mate. And this can't come soon enough. Now, you're a little more cynical than I am, I think, about whether or not this gets pushed through, but I have a massive, massive issue with many of the products, many of the companies, frankly, in our system that exist seemingly to separate us from our hard-earned rather than actually make us money. Anything that separates the difference between investors actually investing literally rather than just straight out gambling. There's a whole lot of stuff that is, frankly, it looks like, you know, it looks like investing because it's offered by people in shiny suits at the top of expensive towers in our capital cities rather than by the bookie at the local racecourse. But any other circumstance would be exactly that. If you're betting on the price or the movement of a share price over 12 hours, I don't know how that's anything other than gambling, despite the fact we let it be called investing because it's linked to the ASX or something else. It just strikes me as a whole lot of stuff there that is at best gambling, at worst, frankly, closer to just basically separating us from our cash, right? Something they know is not going to work for most people, and yet they're allowed to, they're licensed to provide that kind of stuff. I hope that's the first stuff ASIC gets rid of.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think this is good news, as you said. And there's some speculation out there that they're targeting certain derivative products and certain forms of insurance, or what it's called junk insurance.
Yes. CFDs were, contracts for difference, were mentioned in the AFR article as being a potential target for ASIC.
Yeah, so it's all called, I just put that as under the derivative product category, a large category.
Yep.
So also binary options was known as another thing. I think this is good because, you know, here's the thing, right? I know actually of people who, you know, would trade, say, CFDs, and without actually knowing anything about the underlying.
Well, that's the thing. It's no different to going putting money on red or black at the casino. Yeah.
So, you know, and I think a lot of people basically treat stocks and companies as basically the racehorse, in a racetrack or as a roulette in the casino. So I think this is a good move, and it would hopefully save people from their own selves, which is, I think is a good thing. I think, you know, we need to applaud the regulator for doing things that are in the interest of market participants, especially in the interest of a lot of retail market participants, right? Because, you know, they would be putting their hard-earned money on things that actually might not give them any returns. So.
We regulate lotteries as lotteries. We regulate betting as betting. Investing in air quotes. It's one of these. If you go and put $1,000 on red at the casino, you're a problem gambler. If you go and put $1,000 on a CFD on the ASX, you're an investor.
Yeah.
And it drives me mad. It's the, they get a lot of, I said yesterday, they make political spin doctors look like they're, you know, innocents. When you dress something up, which is effectively, it's just straight out gambling, and you call it investing, you say it's on the ASX, and you use all those marketing tricks to make it look sophisticated and clever and what the smart rich people do, and so you should do it too. It's, yeah.
At the bare minimum, you know, even if you don't outright ban the products, for example, at the bare minimum, you need to have like some way of ensuring that the person who is actually participating in that product is actually aware of what that product's risk reward profile is, right?
Yeah, like the outcomes, exactly.
Yeah, so if they understand it, then they're willingly gambling. I guess, you know, everybody's an adult and they, you know, in the market, they're adults at least. And therefore, they, you know, they want to lose their money. It's their choice. Mm-hmm. We can't stop them.
Yep.
And maybe we shouldn't as a society stop
them. That's the thing, because but at some level, these products are almost exactly structured to separate people from their money. It's hard to argue anything other than that when it's literally a, you bet. So if you and I walked into a room with $10 each and the house got to take 10% of every bet and both of us stayed there till one of us lost our money, then let's say you win, right? We own $10 each. By the time we finish, you walk out with 10. I walk out with zero.
Yeah.
And the house gets 10. And you think, well, in what world is that a financial product that should be licensed and regulated by a financial regulator?
Yeah.
Make it an offer to the bookies. Make it a TAB thing. So you've got to go to, if you want to bet on the movement of the market, go and do it with the bookie. And that says, okay, this is gambling outright. Yeah. Don't pretend it's investing.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So when I say, you know, the risk reward should be apparently, you know, very clear, crystal clear.
Yes.
And anybody participating should actually maybe write a small test to, you know, verify that you understand what you're getting into. And I think that makes all logical sense to me.
I would love to see some numbers. I want to see the average win loss for, say, a CFD provider. There shouldn't be a made to say 90% of our clients lost money using this product.
That's probably
fair,
true.
Fair disclosure. And then let people make their own choice. But if you know 90% of people lose money doing this thing, and you want to still do it, then hey, I can't stop you.
Yeah, be my guest, yeah.
I'd still ban it, frankly, but I'll take your point.
but I think this is a really good step on ASICS. You know, again, when the regulator is doing stuff, and we should fully applaud what they're doing. So again, we don't know exactly, so just to clarify, we don't know what they're thinking. They just said that they're going to be looking into this. So there's
so-called
more to come.
Toxic products.
Yeah, more to come.
But for the love of God, don't use CFDs. Just don't. If you use them now, just stop. And if you're going to think about it, please don't. If you want to give your money away, give it to a charity. Like, do something useful with it. Don't bloody give it to some knucklehead on the other side of a different computer screen who happens to get luckier than you. Just madness. I feel better now. This is very cathartic, this podcast, Doc.
I love this podcast.
The bad news is, mate, we're done. That wraps us up for another week. But before we go, don't forget you can and you should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating, leave us a comment, leave us a review, tell your friends. We could do with a few more foolish fans like you. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M.
And before we wrap up, you can also get in touch with us on social media or by email. We're going to do a special mailbag episode in a couple of weeks' time. If you want to have a question, comment, compliment, by all means, feel free to give us a compliment. You know, we
love
people with fragile egos, so we can always do with a bit of just a couple of comments. Doesn't hurt. You can hit us up on Twitter at TheMotleyFoolAU, at TMFScottP, or at Anirban Mahanti. You can also hit us up on email, info@fool.com.au, or on Facebook, where The Motley Fool AU there as well. Give us a comment, give us some feedback, ask us a question, leave us a compliment. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.